This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and this is the Woman's Hour podcast, day one of Listener Week, Monday, August the 24th, 2020. Hi, good morning. It's Listener Week on the programme, so everything we talk about throughout the course of this week has been suggested by you, and we're very grateful to you. It's brilliant to have you so much a part of the programme this week. And we kick off today with the pill. A lot of people want to know more about the pill, it would seem. We'll also discuss women and kayaking, canoeing, paddleboarding, all that sort of thing, really popular at the moment. There's a full-on discussion of head lice, nits in popular parlance. It's not that long ago since, to be honest with you, I presented Woman's Hour with nits. There has been a change of headphones. I think it was, to be fair, about 5 or 6 years ago. So nits on the programme today. And if you are single, or perhaps you've become single recently and you are approaching the dating game, I really hope you can stay around this morning for a conversation about dating apps when you're in your 40s and older. How has it been for you navigating what might be a pretty alien world? How has that world treated you? What do you make of it? Do you think men behave very differently to women? Certainly one listener believes that is exactly the case. If you want to take part on social media, it's at BBC Woman's Hour today. Right, let's get stuck in, and we're starting with the pill. It is more than 50 years since the contraceptive pill became widely available in the UK. Lots of you have got a lot of questions about it. So joining us, Julia Hogan, lead contraceptive and sexual health nurse for Mary Stopes, and Dr. Rebecca French, associate professor of sexual and reproductive health research at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Welcome to you both. Julia, if we can start with you, why is the pill, the contraceptive pill, still so popular?
Hi, Jane. I think there's a number of reasons for that. For one thing, it's what we know about. So often I find when you go to the doctor to ask for contraception, it's what women ask for. So they say, I want to go on the pill. And if you're a busy GP with not a lot of time, that might be the easiest option. Certainly women that I see coming to us at Mary Stopes and in sexual health services, when we'd say, yep, that's fine, you can go on the pill, but do you know about other options? They'll often say, oh, actually, no, nobody's ever spoken to me about them. So it's easy, but also often women don't know that there are other contraceptive methods or other ways of taking the same hormones that are in a combined method, such as the patch or vaginal ring.
Right, but the pill is less invasive and seems easy to use. But of course, you have, and this is really important, Rebecca, you've got to remember to take it, haven't you?
Yeah, no, it is very important to remember to take it. We know if the pill is taken correctly and consistently, less than 1% of women will get pregnant within a year's use. But with typical use, and that's maybe with people forgetting to take pills and things, this can increase to 8 to 9% of women. And some studies have shown maybe younger people sometimes find it harder to remember when to take the pill or when they're getting used to taking it.
And there are how many different sorts in regular use, Julia, across the UK?
With the combined hormonal pill, I'm not sure, but it must be 12, 15 different brands of pill. And with the progesterone-only pill, probably less, probably about four.
And does cost come into it? Does a GP look at how expensive the pills might be?
Is that for me, Jane?
Yes, yeah, if you don't mind.
Yes, yeah. I think that some commissioners will put a cap on different pills. But they're all pretty cheap, to be honest.
All right. Rebecca, a lot of people are asking, one of the most popular questions we've had on this subject is, do you need to have a so-called period? It's not actually a period, is it? It's a withdrawal bleed. People are really asking, can I just take the pill all the time?
Yeah, I mean, the pill can be taken. The standard way is taking the combined pill. You take for 21 days and then you have a 7-day break where you might have some dummy pills that don't have hormones in them. And actually, there's no evidence to suggest that people who do more tailored regimes, so, you know, losing that break and taking the pill continuously, that there are any negative effects. And in fact, there is suggestion that sometimes side effects may be associated when people are having this hormone-free 7 days. So they may find they have headaches or mood changes during this time. So continuously taking the pill might actually reduce these symptoms.
Right. So why is it not routine then to simply take the pill all the time? It does seem bizarre, Rebecca, that we've clung to the idea of having that week off.
Yeah. I mean, I think some women like to have a breakthrough bleed. They sort of...
Why?
I think it's some women feel it sort of mimics their period, so it feels more natural. Some women like to have the bleed thinking, or that sort of is showing, you know, that they're not pregnant. You know, that's what, you know, they feel. So I think these are some of the reasons. But, and I think, you know, these different tailored regimes are becoming more common now. So, you know, maybe that's something... We will see that maybe more women are opting for that.
Julia, what do you think about that?
I think women have a complicated relationship to their bleeding. I mean, actually, if you think about a normal cycle when you're not taking any contraception, you do have that fluctuation in moods, sore boobs, libido, things like that. And so I think women, when they have that break in the pill, they do think, oh, yeah, that's mimicking that natural cycle. But like Rebecca said, I'm seeing a lot more women who are taking pills back to back. And actually, women have always done this, but they've been afraid to tell health professionals because they've thought, oh, they're going to be told off for doing it.
Right.
So women have always taken a pill, like, I'm not going to bleed now because I'm on my holidays.
Yeah, well, you can understand that. But just to be absolutely clear and to nail this, it isn't harmful, Julia, to keep taking the pill and not have that bleed.
Not at all. And in fact, it can increase the effectiveness of the pill because you're not having that dip in your hormones. So, it's good to do that.
Right. That's interesting, isn't it? Rebecca, let's talk about potential links to cancer. What about that? Is there an increased risk of getting some sorts of cancer?
There have been some studies that show there's a very small increased risk of breast cancer and cervical cancer. But this risk declines over time once women have stopped taking the combined oral contraceptive pill. I think the other thing that's maybe not so well known is the benefits of taking the pill. You know, where ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, and even colorectal cancer, your risk decreases. And maybe that's not so commonly known.
I think, Julia, you've got some positive things to say about it in terms of the benefits of the pill.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For one thing, I think that it can really help your mental health if you're in control of your fertility. The pill is very much in the women's control. So if if you're not having sex regularly, your partner's away, you can not be using a method of contraception and then you can start it. You don't have to keep going back to a health professional for that, especially as we now can give a year's worth of pill out at the first visit. So it can improve your skin. And like I say, you've got control over your bleeding.
Yeah, I think a lot of younger women, perhaps with skin conditions they're concerned about, the pill can honestly actively help with skin conditions? Are there particular sorts you'd recommend?
Yeah, it can massively help with skin. I mean, really, it can transform women's skin, especially young women, if you get the right pill. And it's important to say there are lots of different types, so you may start on one and give it 3 to 6 months, and then if that method isn't suiting you, then you can go back to your provider and say, oh, this isn't right, this is the side effect I've got, and then we can try a different pill. There are lots of different types.
Can we just briefly talk about weight gain, because this is something that has been a fairly constant worry. Does it make you put on weight? Rebecca?
There's no clear evidence at all that weight gain is associated with the combined oral contraceptive pill. I mean, I think sometimes with side effects, there could be other factors going on. I don't know, you're starting a new relationship, you're sitting in front of the TV more with your partner, eating pizza, things like that. So there could be other reasons you're gaining weight. But certainly the evidence suggests there is no clear evidence of weight gain.
All right. And the menopause, as you approach the menopause and perhaps you're in the perimenopausal years, is there any evidence at all, Julia, that being on the pill can help?
Yes, actually, it can help with those hot flushes. It can help protect bones up to the age of 50. As long as there's no other contraindications to being on a combined pill, then you could stay on that and it can help. Once you get over 50, and if you were thinking of going on to HRT, it's probably best to ask to see a GP or a menopause specialist that can help you look at the right doses of HRT combined with contraception so that it can support you through that period of time.
All right. I want to get through as many questions as possible. Rebecca, does it affect fertility?
Yeah, there's no delay in terms of return to fertility. The one method where there may be some delay is the injectable contraception. But
How long might you have to wait before trying to get pregnant if you've been using that?
The injectables, Julia might know off the top of her head more than me, but it can be up to 3 to 6 months.
All right. But with the pill, you can take your last one and you could get pregnant 2 weeks later?
Yes. Yeah. There's no evidence of a delay.
OK. What about, this is from Barbara, who emailed to say that we don't talk about the side effects enough. She said she ended up with a bilateral DVT. I don't know which one of you is best to answer that. Rebecca?
Yeah, again, there is a small risk of having a clot in your veins, and most commonly those are sort of in your legs. But I think it's very small. Women not using the combined oral contraception, their risk is 2 in 10,000. This increases to 5, 12 per 10,000 women. So it's very small numbers. And I think the thing is, if there are any signs in terms of swelling in your legs, you should seek help immediately. But it's a very small risk.
Yeah, of course. I mean, everything has a risk, of course, regardless of what it is. Is there any evidence at all that it can affect libido? Anecdotally, some people say it can change the way you feel about your partner. I mean, obviously, it depends on the woman, depends on the pill, presumably. But have either of you heard these stories?
I certainly hear this in my practice. But I hear that about all contraceptive methods, even ones with a really low dose of hormones, to be fair. Mm. And it is hard to say, isn't it? Because certainly I've taken implants out of women when they've said it's affected their libido, and then they've come back to me later saying, oh, can you put one back in? Because actually it was the guy I was sleeping with, not my implant that was causing that. So,
yes. I mean, that surely has to be a factor. Is it just that women are groping around, that's probably the wrong term, looking for an explanation, or perhaps their male partners are? Rebecca, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that. I mean, the research is quite mixed here, but and the evidence, they tend to come from quite small studies that have looked at libido. And as Julia notes, I mean, there could be all sorts of other things going on, like your age, your general health, or what medicines you're using. So, yeah, I would say there's no clear evidence that it affects sex drive.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Rebecca French, Associate Professor of Sexual and Reproductive Health Research at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and Julia Hogan, Lead Contraceptive and Sexual Health Nurse for Mary Stopes. There we go. I hope that's answered a few queries. Interesting that younger women, and perhaps not just younger women, are ditching the idea of the withdrawal bleed and just taking the pill all the time. Any views on that, you can let us know and send us your emails. We'll put them into the Woman's Hour podcast available later. Now, our next topic in Listener Week, all the items we're discussing this week suggested by you, and we're very grateful to you. We should emphasise that. Fiona emailed to say she would just like to suggest coverage of hashtag She Paddles and the initiative by the British Canoeing and Canoe Wales to get more women out paddling. So we're talking here about canoeing, kayaking, paddleboarding, rafting. Katie Lambert runs the She Paddles programme for British Canoeing, and Emma Kitchen has just started training to be a coach to help people improve their paddle skills. Welcome both. Katie, we'll start with you. Tell us, just give us an idea of the range of sports you're talking about here.
That's the fantastic thing with paddle sport. There is such a range. You can do anything from sort of gentle paddling on a canal in a canoe to sort of white water, adrenaline, everything in between. And also the big new thing that a lot more people are doing, especially women, we're finding is stand-up paddleboarding, which can be done on a range of different waters again. It's an absolutely fantastic sport for pretty much anyone of any age and any ability.
Yeah, you say that, but you must need a degree of fitness to even begin, Katie.
I would say you don't need a degree of fitness, you know, to get into a boat and go for a gentle paddle. It's great because it doesn't put pressure on your joints and things. So it's actually a really good way to begin getting fit. Yeah, to get started on your fitness journey, and also to do it in a beautiful setting as well.
And you can't do it on your own. You do need to be with other people, which I guess is also a really nice thing. Great for mental health as well.
Exactly, yes. It's wonderful for meeting new people. You can go down to your local club or centre, go on a course, get your initial skills and meet lots of new people. And also the online community, the women's paddling community online, meeting people through that and getting advice on getting started, that's a really great way of doing it.
All right, let's bring in you, Emma. I know that you've recently got back into the sport. How has it helped you?
It's been absolutely amazing for me. My life changed quite drastically about 3 years ago. And it's really helped me to, I hate using the phrase find myself, but it's really helped me to remember who I am and get back to the things that I used to enjoy when I was a lot younger.
Yeah, don't worry about using phrases like that, because actually I think they're really important, and there's no reason why you shouldn't embrace the person you really were, because I know you've had a few issues. What does it do for you? Is it being outdoors? Is it conquering something? Take me there.
It's a bit of everything, really. So I'm a massive advocate for the great outdoors. I think it's wonderful for so many things: fitness, mental health, just generally great well-being. But also there is an element of wanting to conquer things and, you know, trying to push yourself. So I'm very happy paddling on flat water, you know, on like a nice sheltered river. But at the same time, I quite like the adrenaline rush as well. So I do whitewater kayaking, and I've just started recently doing whitewater stand-up paddleboarding as well.
Right. I mean, that's not for the faint-hearted, surely. There's more than an adrenaline rush there.
there's different, we call them different grades, so there's different difficulty levels in the rivers. So you get some nice, gentle little rapids that you can, like, learn on, and then there's a lot of things that some of my friends do which are quite big and scary to me.
Yeah. The Sunday Times yesterday had a headline: up the coast without a paddleboard, emergency calls soar for water sports. Katie, in your experience, Are novices creating problems for the emergency services at the moment?
I wouldn't call them a problem, but it would be wonderful if people could get some basic safety advice before they get out on the water. The Go Paddling website, gopaddling.info, has got absolutely masses of brilliant articles, and we've published lots more recently, realising that there are more people out on the water after lockdown, just to get give people an idea of what they need to think about before they go. But we would always recommend that people do start off by going to a club or centre, just getting some initial skills, because it really does help to have those basic skills before they go out.
Yeah, and you have to be able to swim more than competently, presumably.
You have to be confident in water. And certainly if you're going out independently, we would recommend that you can swim. But you don't have to be able to swim to get started with a club or centre. You just need to be confident in water, because you will have a buoyancy aid on. It's really important. That if you can't swim, you would always wear a buoyancy aid, but we do recommend that you generally wear them, unless you're on a paddleboard where you are attached to the paddleboard. So some people prefer not to wear them on that. But if you're a beginner, it's just always best to wear one.
And Emma, the kit you need, what do you need to get started?
A kayak, a paddle, a buoyancy aid, or I would even go as far as saying, if you're confident in water but can't swim, go for a life jacket instead, because that helps you float on your back, whereas a buoyancy aid doesn't care which way up you float. Depending on the type of water you're doing, a helmet as well is really useful. That's basically the real basics that you would need. Obviously, a kayak, a canoe, or a paddleboard, or, you know, depending on what discipline you want to go down.
I mean, I haven't got a clue. How much is a second-hand kayak going for these days?
That's a bit of a one at the moment, actually, because it's so popular, it's become quite expensive buying second hand, because the people want them, the demand is there. But usually, I mean, it depends on how new it is. Anything from between £100 to £400 for a second hand one, maybe even more.
Okay, well, I suppose it's just about within reach. If you're really keen, you'll probably make the investment. Emma, you're obviously somewhere outdoors. Where are you at the moment?
I'm in Norfolk, hence the fighter planes going over. I'm actually on a campsite in Norfolk on holiday with my family.
You say that lightly, as though Britain's been invaded and no one's told us at Radio 4, but it's presumably they're not alien fighter planes going over. Well, we'll find out soon enough. The news is on at 11 o'clock. It's been that kind of year, really, hasn't it? Emma, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Enjoy the rest of, I think you're on holiday, aren't you? Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And Katie Lambert from She Paddles. Follow the hashtag. She paddles as well. It's all part of British canoeing, if that's something that's whetted your appetite, no pun intended, and you want to get started on some sort of water sport, and you're keen to kick it off sooner rather than later. Tomorrow, because it's Listener Week all week, we're going to talk about being a young mother. We'll talk to Daisy, who's 24 and has a 9-month-old son. Later in the week, we're going to talk about walking the coastal path in Wales. We're talking about bulimia. We're talking about tending graves and female clan chiefs. All British human life, female life, certainly, is here throughout this week. Knits. Louise Somerville thinks we need to talk more about knits, and she joins us now. Hi, Louise. Good morning to you.
Hi. Good morning.
Are you all right?
I'm good. I'm excited about paddling, actually.
Yeah, well, you're here to talk about knits. I'm glad you've been excited about paddling as well. So that's good. You can get onto that later after we've tackled the head lice issue. I think head lice would it be fair to say they've played a part in your life? I mean, they've played a part in mine, as I said at the beginning of the programme. Your kids are how old, Louise?
Well, my eldest is 29. He's nearly 30. Right. I also have a son who's 26, and I have an 11-year-old, which is why head lice is a current issue for me.
And you believe, and I think this is interesting, that there's a sort of feminist side to this.
That's correct. When I first came across head lice, my now sort of very grown-up child was a small rural village primary school, and the letter came home from school, and it was a really clear letter. I remember being in shock at the time and thinking, oh my goodness, what's this, the infestation? Feeling scared about it, feeling a little bit vulnerable about it.
Yeah.
Was grateful, because not only was there a very clear letter written about the lifespan, how to deal with them, what the technique was, but there was also an illustration with drawings, followed by a note saying, nip along to the school office, and there were combs available, £2 each. So it was not a stigma. It wasn't a stigma at that time. Everybody had the latter. The conversations were happening more, and wet combing with conditioner was definitely the recommended method. And now the situation seems quite different.
Because?
My best guess is that my youngest son has been at a junior school with two male head teachers, and my best guess is that they are not combing their children's hair. And having spoken to a few parents recently, I've discovered that it appears to be the mums that are mostly on the case with dealing with the head combing. And I'm thinking that those head teachers are not recognising that this is a public health issue, that it really affects families and our children. It takes a lot of time to deal with it. And the sooner we are notified of an outbreak, the sooner we can deal with it.
All right, stay with us, Louise. Let's bring in entomologist Richard Jones and Joanna Ibarra, who's from Community Hygiene Concern. Richard, first of all, when head lice... Well, when did they first start? That's an idiotic question, but they seem to have always been with us.
Oh, they have, yes. Head lice have been with humans even before we were human, so many hundreds of thousands of years. So they've adapted incredibly well to survive so long on our heads.
Yeah, well, and they used to be told they only like clean hair. True?
Absolutely not, no. They have, in fact, they any hair at all. The cleanliness of the hair is completely irrelevant. One of the things that I think people don't realise is how active head lice are, how fast they are. We've got this idea of these vermin living amongst the stalks of our hair on our heads.
Yeah.
But actually, if you ever see one moving around, I wanted to photograph one many years ago, and I combed one out of my children's hair and put it on some snipped ends of hair on an envelope. Ooh. And it was very difficult following the beast up and down. They're supremely adapted. If you look at them under a microscope, they're always a delight. They've got the most amazing claws, which are exactly the right size to fit on to human hair.
You know, I don't make a practice of asking men to send me photographs for a string of reasons, but I wouldn't mind seeing that photograph of that knit, if you don't mind, Richard, if that's possible.
I'll see if I can hook it out. It was quite a few years ago, but it should still be around.
I think we'd like to share that with the Woman's Hour audience. Okay, so all different sorts of hair, all ethnicities, every single human can have knits. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely none at all.
All right.
So, yes, wherever you are in the world, there are knits.
Right. And to get rid of them, first of all, to be sort of counterintuitive, does it matter if you've got them?
Probably not on head lice. One of the biological factors to take in is that head lice and body lice are very similar, and whether we call them one species or two species is pretty arbitrary. And we're very lucky that head lice really don't cause us any fuss. But body lice, which I think is luckily something we've eradicated now, spread diseases, mostly through their feces, getting into cuts in the skin. And there are awful reports, usually in times of war or famine or mass migration, terrible disasters where people have got nothing except the clothes they lie down in.
Yeah.
And those clothes are infested. And there are reports of 50,000 lice being retrieved from these people. And at that point, it's unlikely that anemia through blood loss is going to be an issue. But there was certainly the allergic reaction to the saliva that they inject, which has anticoagulant properties. That is a real issue. And that's why, of course, people feel lousy. They get irritable, they have a slight temperature, they can't focus. And this is why, and the nitty-gritty, of course, which is in your hair, which is the droppings, and the idea of a numb skull, because you lost the feeling in your skull because you've been bitten so many times. But these all show that really seriously heavy infestations can have an effect.
Right. I did not know that the term numbskull originated there. Joanne Ibarra from Community Hygiene Concern, what do you advise if a family has knits? What's the solution?
Well, first, let's pick up on the fact that lice move very quickly in dry hair. But if they are bathed in moisture, if they're really wet, they stay still. And the easiest way to get your hair really wet is to wash it with ordinary shampoo and then put on any conditioner, and that will keep the lice really wet and sodden and soaking while you are facilitated with untangling and straightening the hair with an ordinary wide-tooth comb. And then you can come in with the bright yellow bug buster comb and hook them out very easily. And that's the way that you know that you've got lice.
Yeah, now this can take...
easy way to address it.
Well, you say easy, it's quite time-consuming, isn't it? Depending on the length of hair.
Yes, but you've got to bear in mind that if you don't detect lice, and this is the way to detect it when you've got a low number of lice on the head, unbeknown to you, because they're probably not even causing telltale itching, your child might be passing them on and picking them up from other children whose parents don't know that they're children have got lice, and they're going round and round and round, which means that lots of people end up doing successive treatments one after another when they realise that there's a problem.
Yeah.
So we introduced bug busting, wet combing, detection of lice days. The next one is at Halloween, 31st of October. And the simplest way for schools to bring parents back in and keep them informed and get their united action going is to inform them about our helpline. There's a one-to-one helpline.
All right. Well, yeah, OK. We are... I'm sure we can put links up on our website so people can get more information about that. I'm quite interested, Louise, in your theory about height and nits. Can you just remind me of that?
Well, it's something I saw on Twitter this morning. I looked on Twitter to see if any men were talking about head lice or if, again, it was just the women.
Yes.
And one mum put that her child, Touchwood, had never had an infestation of head lice, and another parent responded with, "Is your child tall?"
Yeah. And?
And it turns out that, according to the mums on Twitter, that if your child is tall, their heads are further away from the other children and that lice seem to move down. But I'm also particularly interested in what Richard said about the speed and how Joanna countered that by saying that when your hair is very wet, they don't move as fast. So I'm going to put myself in the firing line of embarrassment now and say that when combing my hair a couple of weeks ago, because we've had a recent outbreak of head lice in July during lockdown, strangely enough, I was combing on one side and then I felt that there was an itch or a movement on the other side of my head. So then I moved the comb to the other side and I'm practically thinking, this is ridiculous. Head lice don't have a brain. They can't move away from the comb. Is there any point in combing one side of my hair and then quickly moving to the other side?
Okay.
Or should I be going all the way round the head in a more orderly fashion?
Well, very briefly, that's one for Richard.
Yes, several centimetres a second, or a couple of centimetres a second they can move. They're incredibly fast. Yes, it's funny how you can sometimes feel them crawling around. I'm quite proud, I think, to be the only man who's ever combed and knit a head lice out of his hair and then presented it as an exhibit that same day at a meeting of a National Entomological Society.
How proud your whole family must be, Richard.
They are, yes. I remind them of this all the time. The speed they move is incredible, and I think that's something to take into account when thinking about head lice transferring around the classroom. And as a good biogeography analogy that you can borrow here, and that your child's head is not a lone island. They don't have an infestation that you have to cope with. They're part of an archipelago, and a head lice can start on one child and possibly move through half a dozen other heads before it gets to the end of the day in a classroom. They really are incredibly active, and because they're very small, people miss that key biological point, and that's actually how infestations get around so fast.
Thank you all very much. very much. I think we've all learned something in the last 10 minutes or so. Richard Jones, Joanna Ibarra and Louise in Somerset, who is our listener who kicked the whole thing off. I know that we did have an email towards the end of last week from a listener who said her children had just gone back to school in Scotland. Within 48 hours, the NIT letter had come home. So NITs are certainly back at school, in common with some British school children. I know more to go back over the next couple of weeks. Now, I promised you a conversation about dating apps and being in your 40s and indeed your 50s. Elizabeth is a listener who wanted to talk about this during Listener Week. She joins us now. Elizabeth, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, Elizabeth, just tell us a little bit about yourself. You're newly single for a start.
Yes, been single just a couple of years now. And so it is a new thing for me. The last time I was probably properly single was when I was in sixth form, which is a very long time ago.
And dating had changed whilst you'd been married. And the dating apps in particular, just tell me a little bit about your experience of using them.
I was recommended by a male friend to have a go at a couple of different dating apps, which I did. And I found that rather than being empowering, as one of them claims it is for women, it was actually quite confidence destroying when you find that you invest time and energy and effort into matching with people, starting a conversation with them, only to find that they either have right swiped on just about every woman on the app because they want to see how many swipes they get in return. It's a little dopamine hit for them. It makes them feel good. Or perhaps, and especially during lockdown, it's a way for them to while away the evening, perhaps if the football's a bit boring, and they really have no intention of ever getting as far as going on a date with you.
And you don't think that women use them in the same way?
I think perhaps as a woman, you set out thinking, I'll go on this app, I'll put myself out there. If you've just come out of a relationship, your self-esteem might be a little bit low anyway. And to then find you're sort of being used as a bit of an ego boost, I don't think women would do that in reverse. Perhaps I'm wrong, but it seems to me that we go into it more with the idea that this is a way to meet people.
Elizabeth, stay with us. Dr. Martin Graff is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of South Wales. This is your area, Martin. You've researched it. Is Elizabeth onto something?
I think what you said is pretty accurate in some respects. The same seems to be the case as well, I think, for women. There's evidence to suggest that women kind of use this as well as men, dating apps and dating sites, to get that kind of little bit of a self-esteem boost. So I think, you know, both sexes might be guilty of that. But I can appreciate the whole kind of problem of, you know, using this and not getting much success. That is the kind of thing which obviously is going to sort of put you off. But I guess we have to realise that, you know, dating as you get a little bit older is probably different to how it was when you were younger.
Yeah, but can I just put it to you, yeah, and I think we'll get onto this in a minute with,
sure,
Elizabeth, it's not quite so different for men as it is for women, particularly when it comes to age.
In what way?
Well, because men feel absolutely no problem at all in dating considerably younger than their real age, whereas women, miraculously, in their 40s and 50s, are expected to start finding men 20 years older than them attractive.
So I think, well, I don't know, I'm not too sure about that, but
let's ask Elizabeth what she thinks.
Okay.
Go on, Elizabeth.
I've certainly found that when you look at certain sites, it will tell you that the man is looking for women. They might be, say, 52, 53, and they're looking for a woman who is under the age of 43. And it's almost as though they do not want to date women their own age. They want to sort of go back in time and date somebody younger. Now, that's not to say that as a woman, I wouldn't want to date somebody younger as well. But I do feel like quite a few of my male friends have admitted to me, and they're the same age as me or a little bit older, that I wouldn't ever come up in their feed because I'm too old.
OK, back to you, Martin.
OK, so I think that is the case. And there's a kind of very good sort of biological reason, which are a bit too long to explain at the moment.
Give us a whirl. Go on. Tell us what it is.
It's an evolutionary psychology explanation. You're going to hate me for saying this. But sort of fertility is related to how you look outwardly. Men retain the fertility longer than women generally. Therefore, that accounts for that kind of age disparity. But what we have to do really, just come back to it, and to not to sort of end on that point, is to be realistic, I think, and not to sort of go into this, men and women, with a kind of shopping list, a kind of list of requirements, then, if you like. That's the kind of mistake I think people make, male and female.
What do you mean, too choosy?
Not necessarily too choosy, but kind of just drop that kind of assessment mindset, trying to sort of imagine who you might look at and who you think you might have a good time with, rather than coming in with that kind of shopping list of requirements which you want, which is kind of natural to do after you've been in a relationship for so long, I guess.
I am going to give away the fact that I talked to Elizabeth before the programme. I talked to her about 8:30 this morning, and Elizabeth, just tell the listeners what we were talking about earlier, because I'm particularly interested in the fact that you had invested in a really long conversation with a man. I think it was 4 hours, 5 hours. And then what happened?
I did. And what happened was we chatted away. And the way I felt about it was that there seemed to be a rapport there. And then suddenly, having said sort of, we'll chat again tomorrow, he just unmatched me and disappeared. And I think the analogy I used this morning was, I don't think you'd catch someone's eye in a bar if you were out for the evening, sit at a table with them, have a drink, spend a few hours chatting, and then halfway through a sentence they get up and walk out the door without a backward glance. It would feel very strange to do that, and yet with apps and online dating that seems to be the norm.
That is a kind of sad reality, I guess, of the online world, because of what we call kind of a little bit of a disinhibition effect, if you like, that people are less inhibited about how they might act. I'm sorry to hear that, but that is kind of what, not often, but can happen. People can disappear without a count.
It feels like we're getting at men who use dating apps here, Martin, but I mean, without giving too much away, I do hear from people that this kind of thing does happen, and it tends to be men behaving in this way.
Okay. Like I said, I think that's just a sad reality of the online world, that people will do that. I'm not sure there's evidence to suggest that men do it more than women, or women do it more than men.
Okay. Well, put it out. I know our listeners are going to respond to this item.
Sure.
Elizabeth, you can only talk from your own experience, can't you?
I can. And I didn't really expect to have to, as one friend put it, get, skin as tough as an alligator when I went to online dating. It was sort of the thing where you think, it'll be nice, I'll go out and I'll meet some new people. And I have actually made some friends through the dating apps, male friends, who has been the upside of it. But I do feel like at a time when perhaps you're new to this and things have changed a lot if you've been married for 20 or more years, it is a bit of a shock when you suddenly realise that the normal good manners that might apply if you were on an evening out just simply do not apply online.
There's quick a whole word different, from you, Martin.
Yeah, there's a whole different kind of set of, for want of a better phrase, set of rules around this. People act differently online than they do face to face, and the online dating world is different to the sort of meeting face to face world, if you like. There are more people, but people might act rather more unpleasantly than they might face to face. We're kind of accountable face to face, and we're not accountable online. Therefore, that probably accounts for these things happening.
Thank you, Martin. That's Martin Graff. And Elizabeth, are you going to keep going or packing it in for a while, or what's your approach going to be?
I think I'm going to just concentrate on enjoying myself. I'm furloughed at the moment. I'm looking at doing some voluntary work, and I think I'm going to concentrate on that more than I am looking at dating sites, because I think sometimes you look back on a day and think, oh, well, that was a waste of time. I could have spent my time much more productively, so I'm going to do that instead.
That was Elizabeth. It's not actually her real name, but that was the name we chose for her this morning, and she was one of our listener contributors to the first day of Listener Week on the programme. And thanks to everybody who's emailed and tweeted with suggestions. We really, really appreciate it. And I think a lot of people actually just enjoy hearing what other listeners want to hear about. So it's pretty positive stuff on the whole. Now, to the conversation with Elizabeth, quite a big reaction from you. Joe on email says, my experience is that men do have unrealistic expectations of who they can date. Online dating for them is like picking out their dream car, but without the budget. Men my age, I'm 44, are looking for women in their mid-30s. I felt I had to start looking for men in their early 50s and hope they took a more mature approach to relationships. Eventually, I gave up online dating, says Jo. Victoria says, I learnt from two rounds of online dating to meet straight away rather than spend a load of time on communication and to never contact any men looking for younger women. I am now engaged to someone I met online. From Sue, I met my husband online 13 years ago today. We were both 62. We were married a year ago and I have never been happier. Oh, Sue, well, congratulations. It's good to get a positive story. We were both widowed, Sue goes on to say. Before we met, I spent years dating online and, of course, met good, bad and indifferent men. My advice is to stick at it and you may well find happiness. There we are. Tim says, I agree with Elizabeth. It is time-consuming, hard work, expensive and it can be disheartening. Agencies could help by only publishing profiles with photos. Rule one, ensure you know where the delete button is before you chat. Those deleted will not be able to make any additional contact. And please note, not all blokes are predatory and some women are. Right, I absolutely take that. From Tom, I'm a 53-year-old man who has met and is now going out with a 55-year-old woman. So there we are. Helen, slightly cynically, says, it strikes me that that story that Elizabeth told about the man who disappears suddenly after a four-hour conversation online, I think his wife's just come in, says Helen. I mean, I don't know why I'm laughing, because it is possible, unfortunately, isn't it? But thank you for that, Helen. And David, in my experience, women behave just the same as she says men do and have done so long before the internet dating started. She needs, says David, to be more realistic. OK, well, a range of opinion there, but I'm just very grateful to Elizabeth for coming on because it's not always the easiest topic to talk about. And as I say, a lot of people who have been out there and have tried it and have suffered a bit, it isn't easy. I think you do need a thick skin. They would have enjoyed somebody else just talking through some of the issues. The pill. Jan says, thank you so much for that conversation about the pill, but why has it taken so long? I took the pill throughout the 70s and found the effects of the withdrawal period very unpleasant, particularly night sweats, which left me feeling exhausted. I thought that break in taking it was essential, but found the only way to continue to work effectively was to take the pill continuously until I could book a holiday about every 3 months in order to take the break. I always imagined it must be men who thought women would ever want unnecessary periods. Isn't that interesting? I mean, I think we have done this issue on Woman's Hour before in the past. There are all sorts of theories about why the people who came up with the pill had that break. And I know the Catholic Church was consulted. And yeah, there really was the theory. The theory was out there that women would, quote, like a period. I mean, if you're out there and you've thoroughly enjoyed a period, do let us know. But I've got to say, it's never a highlight for me. Pat says, I'm 71 and I took the pill from 17 until postmenopause with three childbirth breaks. And once it was recommended, I used the coil. The pill for me, though, was wonderful. No side effects. Best thing to happen for women. Complete control over childbirth for the first time ever. But there's always another side to it. And Lucy on email says, the pill messed up my body catastrophically and did to many of my friends as well. Infertility problems, psychosis, lack of libido, depression and years without ovulation. I think it's a complex issue, says Lucy. Now on to NITs. Oh, so many. I could spend the rest of the day reading out some of your theories on NITs. But I just want to bring in Phyllis, who describes herself as a tall... Sorry, I'm just using the screen here. My remedial mouse training, which I had some years ago, still comes in handy. Phyllis says, as a tall primary school teacher, I've caught head lice countless times. I'm afraid they don't just move from head to head, but also from head to clothes. After one child gave me a spontaneous hug, I happened to look down and found a head louse marching north, up my top, towards my head. How very lovely. Now, Richard, our entomologist who took part in the conversation, did indeed tweet that image he told us about, and Woman's Hour has retweeted it. So if you're looking for that lovely, lovely shot of the head louse in action, then you can go to the Woman's Hour Twitter feed and you'll see it. It's absolutely gorgeous. Lindsay is in Australia She's an ex-head teacher from the UK, extremely familiar, she says, with all that is head lice-ridden, including myself. She does say social distancing should surely be the demise of the knit, however speedy. Well, I don't know about that, actually. If they more sort of athletic lice might be able to bounce about from one bonce to another. There's a suggestion that might be possible. And what else have we got on knit? Oh, yes, it's from Julia on Twitter. I recall the 1960s knit nurse who went to schools and checked every child's hair with a comb and disinfectant as we stood in line. Never worried it would be me, only giggled. But our hair was washed once a week, if that. Cut to my 80s and 90s kids who got knit six or more times from nursery onwards. Well, Julia, yeah, I too stood in line for Knitty Nora, the head explorer, who also, if I remember rightly, checked your nails. She also looked at your fingernails. That definitely happened in Liverpool in the 70s. Quite what they were looking for there. I mean, I suspect it might have been... would that have been? Just signs of neglect? I don't know. I certainly remember trembling in the line for Knitty Nora, who certainly didn't just do heads. She also looked at your nails. Water sports, paddle boarding. This is important from Kerry. Did I hear your contributors suggesting it was OK to go out on a paddle board and not be able to swim first? Ridiculous, says Kerry. It should be the first vital skill. Well, I was a bit surprised by that myself. I mean, I did say to them, surely you need to be able to swim really pretty competently to even attempt it. I mean, I'm with you, Kerry. I don't think it would be ridiculous to attempt something like that if you weren't a good swimmer. Jane says, I went kayaking on the Jurassic Coast last weekend for the first time in my life. I'm 58 this week. My girlfriend had to persuade me because I didn't realise that in a kayak you're sitting on top and not with the legs snug into the vessel, where I'd imagined I might struggle to get free if I tipped. You don't tip over, however. It was energetic yet restful, and it felt very peaceful. I thoroughly recommend it. Well, there you go. Well, that does sound positive. And from Beverly, I'm 67, just went back to kayaking after 25 years. You don't need to buy all this expensive kit at once. Many UK coastal and canal areas have local clubs that you can join, and they'll lend you equipment for a small amount. Water sport is a beautiful way to travel through the natural landscape and build healthy and trusting relationships with others who enjoy nature. I think we'll pack it in today on a positive note. Tomorrow, on day two of Listener Week, we're talking about, finding out that you're pregnant unexpectedly at the age of 23 and having to get to grips with it in a very short period of time. So that's one of our items tomorrow. And we're also looking forward to talking to a listener who's just exploring nature in a wonderful way by walking the Wales Coastal Path. So she is on the programme tomorrow. And I think we're still open for ideas. So if you've got anything you're desperate to talk about, let us know what it is. You can email the programme via the website, bbc.co.uk/womanshour.
Are you still there? Good. There's someone I want you to meet. Their name is Sean, they're 16, and they're in trouble. Follow Sean's journey by subscribing to Power It on BBC Sounds. The world is dying. It's time to take action. Power. Power. Power.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?